This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
As more attention is being given to the problem of bullying in schools, more attention is being focused on the bullies themselves. What is it that causes a bully to be a bully?
Some of the children who bully, and possibly even some of the most persistent bullies, are children who are listening to those messages and are saying to themselves, "That doesn't describe me."
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look into the minds of bullies and then hear from the NIH about predicting psychological illnesses. We'll also hear about a cheating scandal at a New York State university that's causing concern throughout the region. And we'll spend an academic minute feeling good about ourselves. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In any situation that involves bullying, the first concern is going to be with the victim, and rightly so. But what about the bullies themselves? What do we know about the psychology of these people that makes them turn to bullying? In the fourth part of our series on bullying, The Best of Our Knowledge's Patrick Donges takes a closer look at the mind of a bully.
Tyler Gregory, a freshman at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, knows firsthand what makes a bully tick.
I was doing it not to make her hurt, but to get laughs, like to build me up.
As a high school student in South Charleston, Ohio, just west of the state capital of Columbus, Tyler and his friends began bullying a girl from another school via the internet. While their bullying didn't end in tragedy, Tyler says it was only after his recognition of the direst consequences that he realized what he was doing.
There was one time a friend of ours took the phone, and it was a girl, and she said, you know, go kill yourself. And when I actually heard that, that's when it clicked. That's when it really clicked. I was like, if she actually went and killed herself, you know, I would have to live with that guilt. All my friends would have to live with that guilt. And there's no going back once something like that happens.
Bridgewater State University professor Dr. Elizabeth Englander, director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center, which conducts bullying research and provides training to faculty and students at K-12 schools, says many bullies don't realize they're being abusive.
Sometimes children do realize what they're doing because they're testing the ground, they're engaging in the behavior deliberately to show other peers that they are powerful, and so they may be aware of it, but I think also frequently children don't view what they've done as bullying. And this is problematic because a lot of times we talk about bullying prevention in school and we talk about bullying as an issue in school, but what may be happening is that some of the children who bully, and possibly even some of the most persistent bullies, are children who are listening to those messages and are saying to themselves, "That doesn't describe me."
As for the motivations for bullying, Englander says they can vary based on the level of individual involvement.
Like all abuse behaviors, ultimately it's really about power and control. Kids are very motivated to gain social status through bullying. In general, children recognize that bullying is about power and control, and overwhelmingly, they cite that as the most important motive. And I think ultimately, it is the most important motive. But children who bully themselves tend to see anger as their motive rather than power. So they see the problem that they have with other kids as a sort of social relationship problem that really has to do with them becoming angry at the person. I think that anger isn't necessarily the ultimate cause, but I think it's possibly a trigger and maybe a very important one.
Dr. Marlene Sandstrom, professor of psychology at Williams College, conducts research focusing on adolescent social relationships and the factors that can lead to bullying behaviors.
Psychologists are really interested in developmental pathways, and it turns out that bullying is a really complex problem, and there's no single pathway to get there. I can't tell a single story that would explain how a young child would become a bully, but there are a lot of risk factors that accumulate and make it more likely that a child would engage in bullying.
Among those risk factors, according to Sandstrom, are inherent or inherited personality traits.
Early temperament plays a role for sure. Some children just come into the world having difficulty regulating their feelings from a very early age. Some children inherit a tendency toward impulsivity. And then as children get a little older, we see that a lack of empathy, you know, just an inability to appreciate the emotional reactions of others, particularly fear and sadness in other people, that predicts bullying behavior. And so does a sense of moral disengagement, and that's something we see when kids get a little older. This idea that some people are less important than others or don't deserve the same level of respect. Bullies also hang pretty firmly to the belief that using aggression is just a good way to get what you want.
Other risk factors deal with the family or school environment. Again, here's Sandstrom.
The kinds of characteristics of families that are associated with bullying are things like low levels of trust in the family, poor communication skills, parents who don't monitor or supervise their children very carefully, high levels of conflict in the home, violence and abuse in the home. So it's a very complicated set of factors that all interact with each other.
These factors point to the idea that bullies can come in all shapes and sizes, and that, according to Sandstrom, they rarely fit the stereotype of a schoolyard bully.
One myth about bullying is that bullies tend to be these oafish kinds of big kids that maybe aren't very smart and have low self-esteem, and that they're bullying other kids to try to boost up their own sense of self. And there's actually very little evidence to support that view. It seems that bullies tend to have average, if not overinflated, sense of self.
Tyler Gregory is a living example of that. Here he is describing his high school experience.
I had good grades, and I did a lot of community service, and I was an all-around good kid. No, I definitely don't think self-esteem was an issue.
Citing a study led by Dr. Deborah Pepler, distinguished research professor in the health department at York University in Toronto, Canada, that followed several children throughout their early academic careers, Dr. Sandstrom says that for many, bullying is a passing phase that ends during or after high school.
What they discovered was really interesting. One group of kids, a little over 40% of them, just didn't report much bullying at all. And then there's a second group, about 15% of kids, who reported engaging in a moderate level of bullying in elementary school, but then they consistently decreased that bullying behavior to near zero by the time they were out of high school. Then there was another group of kids, about 35% of kids, who reported moderate levels of bullying that remained stable all the way through middle school and through high school. And then the last group, 10% of kids, reported very high levels of bullying that started early in elementary school and remained consistently high through high school.
It's that 10%, Sandstrom says, that are the most troubling, as studies have shown that chronic childhood bullies often carry their bullying into adulthood.
So it's really an example of using violence within the context of an interpersonal relationship. And that's the same dynamic that is at the core of other more adult forms of aggression, like sexual harassment and dating aggression and workplace harassment and marital abuse and child abuse.
It's the transposition of those adolescent experiences into serious problems later in adulthood that researchers say is what makes large anti-bullying campaigns and initiatives so important. Dr. Elizabeth Englander says that while it's important to work with kids on an individual basis, community and statewide campaigns, like those established over the past several years in the wake of such high-profile cases like the suicides of Phoebe Prince and Tyler Clementi, are imperative to stop bullying.
I think a public health model is a better model. So looking at social factors, looking at things like attitudes and policy and social behaviors that really contribute on a broad scale is the most efficient way to cope with these kinds of problems.
Among those types of initiatives is the Great American No Bull Challenge, a bullying awareness campaign where kids are asked to submit short documentary-style films about bullying with the chance to watch their work screened at the Sundance Film Festival. After his bullying experience, Tyler Gregory apologized to the girl and told his parents. Then he and fellow classmate Scott Hanna submitted a video to the No Bull contest and became active in local anti-bullying campaigns, eventually becoming national spokespeople for the No Bull campaign. Here's Tyler.
I feel that lifting people up lifts me up more than any of the putting down that I had ever done.
Tyler's outlook on stopping bullying echoes the views of researchers who continue to study the psychological effects and causes of bullying. Their work goes on.
It's been around for a long time, and I think it's going to continue to be around, but there's definitely things that we can do to alleviate it.
I'm Patrick Donges.
So is there any way of predicting that your child might grow up to be a bully? Perhaps someday. A study from the National Institutes of Mental Health says that scientists can already predict psychotic illness in up to 80% of high-risk youth. Wally Akinzo reports.
Scientists can predict psychotic illness in up to 80% of high-risk youth, according to a study by the National Institute of Mental Health. Youth who are going to develop psychosis can be identified before their illness becomes full-blown 35% of the time if they meet widely accepted criteria for risk. But that figure rises to 65 to 80% if they have certain combinations of risk factors. Dr. Robert Heinzen, the study's principal investigator, breaks down the focus of the study.
This study focuses on our ability to predict individuals who are at highest risk for developing a psychotic disorder within a time frame that actually can inform clinical decision making. So prior to this study, the best predictor of who was going to go on to develop psychosis was family history of psychotic illness. If you had a first-degree relative, that being either a parent or a sibling who had a psychotic disorder, your risk was somewhere between 10 and 12% over the course of a lifetime. With this study, we use a set of clinical indicators that are evaluated in a structured diagnostic interview, and we found that individuals who meet these clinical characteristics have a 35% risk of developing psychosis over a 30-month interval. So we've been able to triple the predictive accuracy with this new instrument, and we've been able to clarify the risk window from a time frame of decades to a time frame measured in months.
Dr. Heinzen said knowing what the combinations of risk factors are can help scientists predict who is likely to develop the illnesses within 2 to 3 years with the same accuracy that other kinds of risk factors can predict major medical diseases.
So the criteria that have been tested are the presence of what's called attenuated positive symptoms. So these would be changes in thinking and communication that would be seen as milder forms of the types of disturbances that we see in active psychosis. So for example, unusual thoughts, suspiciousness and paranoia, disorganized communication, those would all be examples at a given level of severity. At a given time frame, we would say that the person has stepped out of the normal range of experience on these dimensions and now is in a precarious risk state that we would want to monitor carefully to see whether that progressed further. Additional ways that you could be in this risk state are if you had a family history of psychosis, similar to what I was describing before, but on top of that, you've had a significant functional decline over the preceding 12 months. So you've experienced noticeable changes in your ability to take care of yourself or to perform your roles as either a student or a worker. That would be another route to this.
The other combinations of risk factors that predicted psychosis were past or current drug abuse and the deteriorating of one's social functioning. According to Dr. Heinzen, research shows that intervention during the early stages of psychosis improves outcomes, but it is not yet clear if even earlier intervention before a psychotic illness develops is effective. Dr. Heinzen emphasizes that researchers now have the tool that actually has value for clinical practice today.
If a young person presents at a clinic and they are evaluated using the structured diagnostic interview and are found to be in this risk state, what it tells us is that you can treat the symptoms that they present with that have existing therapies associated with them.
Dr. Heinzen added that once researchers identify people being high risk, they have a very good chance of knowing whether or not they're likely to develop a serious mental disorder like schizophrenia, and that if they do, it will happen fairly quickly. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Still to come, a cheating scandal in New York State is causing concern in schools around the region. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link.
You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1182. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A cheating scandal in New York State at the University at Albany is causing concern not only at the university. Neighboring schools are also taking note. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
The story broke in the college newspaper. The Albany Student Press carried the headline, "Cashing in on cheating. Student-run operation charges money for completion of online assignments." The paper says it received and verified information provided by anonymous students that as many as 500 students have been paying other students to do their assignments. Those involved were reportedly enrolled in Professor Peter Ross's Computer Applications in Business course. The news came as no surprise to UAlbany student and WAMC News intern Matthew Don Diego.
I have friends that were talking about it. They said that the professor hasn't changed the course in a number of years, and that when you enroll in the class, it's kind of known that, or expected to, be able to cheat on the assignments.
Transactions were said to have been accomplished via social networking. The ASP published the name and Facebook account of the student who allegedly masterminded the scheme. Brooke Ballard could not be reached and may have taken his Facebook page down. He told the Times Union he does not charge anyone for completion of assignments, but explained he offers tutoring to students and help on specific questions if they ask. The executive board of the Albany Student Press responded to a request for comment by email, quote, "Only time will tell if this sort of alleged scandal will tarnish the reputation of the university. It is difficult to tell right now, and to speculate would be dangerous. Unfortunately, this sort of activity takes place all across the nation at all sorts of schools. To speculate on the impact now would be premature." Dr. Maggie Kerwin is the interim provost and vice president for academic affairs at the College of St. Rose in Albany. She says cheating is a national problem, not unique to SUNY.
One of the things we try to do is switch the equation. Instead of policing, and of course we do have a police mechanism, but instead of policing, we try to promote academic integrity.
Late last summer, news broke that 125 Harvard students were implicated in a cheating scandal stemming from collaboration on a final exam in a political science class. Harvard now is weighing whether to introduce a student honor code. I asked UAlbany senior Matthew Don Diego if he thought cheating students might be driven by pressure to succeed in today's world, where tuition tends to run high, leaving graduates in serious debt.
I definitely think that for larger universities, especially using Harvard as the example, that the pressure to do well when paying so much money definitely comes into effect. I don't think cheating is the answer, but I think it definitely factors in that they're paying for their education, and they're fearing that they won't do as well. For UAlbany students in particular, I don't think that the financial burden is necessarily why they're cheating. I think that it's known that it's easy to get away with cheating in some of the larger classes. And I think that it's an easy way out for a lot of students.
Addressing the allegations of student misconduct, UAlbany also responded to a request for comment by email, quote, "The university takes any violation of its student code of conduct very seriously, including academic dishonesty and fraud, and is conducting a thorough investigation. If warranted, such cases are referred to the university's Office of Conflict Resolution for appropriate disciplinary sanctions." Robert Baker is director of ethics across the curriculum at Union College in Schenectady.
What the students did was a fundamental betrayal of trust of the relationship that they have with their professors. It also says that they think of education as a series of hoops that they have to jump through in order to get a scrap of paper that'll give them an entitlement to certain kind of positions in society, rather than a way of developing a knowledge base and skill set that will improve themselves and contribute to the world around them.
Brooke Ballard, the student reportedly at the heart of UAlbany's scandal, told the Times Union he is disgusted that the student paper named him as a cheat. He is exploring legal options and expects to be cleared at a school hearing. Professor Ross told the TU he is determining which students cheated. He conceded he doesn't know how far that activity extends. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
You know, it turns out that being a good Samaritan helps not only the person in need, but the Samaritan, too. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Scientists have long sought a better understanding of altruistic behavior in both humanity and the animal kingdom. And as Michael Poulin, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Buffalo, explains, when you factor in the human psyche, sometimes it's just better to give than to receive.
Is giving to others good for you? Volunteering, helping friends and neighbors, supporting loved ones, all of that stuff we do to benefit others, is it good for you? I mean, sure, we know it's morally good, but that doesn't mean that giving to others makes us happier or healthier. Or does it? You may have heard that stress is bad for health. Well, it turns out that giving to others may undo the negative effects of stress. In a recent study, my colleagues and I found that there was no link between stress and health among people who reported helping their friends and neighbors in the past year. But among people who didn't engage in such helping, stressful life events predicted decreased odds of survival over the next 5 years. Before you run out to the nearest soup kitchen to get your daily dose of helping, though, I should point out that there's a catch. Helping appears to only be good for you if you really care about those you're helping. In two separate studies, I found that volunteering on behalf of strangers also weakens the link between stress and health, but only for volunteers who have generally positive views of other people. In other words, helping may be good for you specifically to the extent you're likely to experience compassion for those you help. Together, these studies suggest a potentially surprising way in which our connections to others affect our health. But I also think the link between helping and health, by being written in our biology, sheds new light on what it means that humans are, as Aristotle said, the social animal. We're not just drawn to others because of what they can do for us. We're also drawn to others because of what we can do for them.
That was Michael Poulin of the University at Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.